3, 2, 1.
What will the world look like 10 or 20 years from now? The Wall Street Journal's Future of Everything podcast is here to give you a peek. And we can't wait to show you what's coming. Subscribe now.
The crypto sell-off continues, sending Bitcoin to its lowest level since 2020. Plus, Finland's leaders announced their intention to join NATO, and the Biden administration bets on private generosity as it rolls out its Ukrainian refugee resettlement program.
The benefit is it gets Ukrainians here really quick, but on the flip side, they get none of the resettlement support from the government, and they don't get green cards.
It's Thursday, May 12th. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. Here's the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. The president and prime minister of Finland have announced their support for the country applying for NATO membership, making it all but certain the Nordic nation will join the alliance in response to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. The move would represent a major break from decades of Finland's non-aligned defense policy and deal a blow to Russian President Vladimir Putin's ambition to divide and weaken the Western alliance. Finland's neighbor Sweden is weighing a similar move to apply for NATO membership. U.S. stock futures have fallen, pointing to a possible second day of turbulence on Wall Street as inflation worries weigh on investors. The price of Bitcoin dropped to $26,000 this morning, its lowest level since December 2020. The cryptocurrency market has come under significant pressure during the sell-off in stocks. North Korea has imposed a lockdown in all its major cities after reporting its first local case of COVID-19 more than 2 years after the pandemic began. North Korea has not vaccinated its population and is particularly vulnerable to the pandemic, owing to poor healthcare infrastructure and widespread malnourishment. WSJ reporter Dossal Yoon has more.
North Korea watchers say that prolonged lockdowns could precipitate secondary health and food crises, as imports of food and humanitarian aid have been restricted during the pandemic. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has already warned of potential food shortages, and without widespread vaccination, North Korea is unlikely to be able to restore an economy that largely depends on cross-border trade with China.
The U.S. Senate has voted to confirm economist Philip Jefferson to the Federal Reserve. With the confirmation, 3 of the 6 sitting Fed governors are now appointees of President Joe Biden. Yesterday, the Senate also confirmed law professor Alvaro Bedoya to the Federal Trade Commission. Bedoya's confirmation gives Democrats a 3-2 majority at the FTC, potentially energizing the agency's scrutiny of large tech companies. And Japanese technology investor SoftBank Group has reported its biggest annual loss in its 4-decade history because of the global sell-off in technology shares. The publicly listed stocks that compose much of SoftBank's $100 billion Vision Fund have fallen by more than half since the start of the year. As the war in Ukraine drags on and Western sanctions against Russia tighten, the conflict's toll on global economic growth is rising, particularly in Europe. Only a few days ago, Germany, Europe's manufacturing powerhouse, reported a nearly 4% decline in its manufacturing sector compared to the previous month. Wall Street Journal reporter Paul Hannon joins us now with more. Paul, thank you for being with us as always.
Good to talk to you again, Luke.
So, Paul, why is Europe in a worse situation than the United States right now?
Well, it's mainly to do with the war, with Russia's invasion of Ukraine and what that has done to energy prices, which is to push them up from already very high levels even further. And here in Europe, what we're looking at is a rise in home energy prices that in a single year is larger than anything that happened in the 1970s, which is the decade that's famous for rapid energy price rises and very negative economic consequences. One difference that sort of stands out is that Europe doesn't make much of its own energy. The US is much more kind of self-reliant. And what that means is that when the price of energy rises, as it has done very, very sharply, you almost literally get a transfer of spending power out of Europe and to whatever countries are supplying that energy, Russia, Saudi Arabia, Algeria, and others, including, by the way, the US, now that Europe is looking to the US for more of its liquefied natural gas to replace some Russian supplies. So loss of spending power means that there's much less money to spend on things that are made inside Europe. I mean, in the US, what you're getting is a transfer of resources from energy consuming to energy producing states, but there's nothing like that kind of big outflow from the economy as a whole.
On both sides of the Atlantic now, there is talk of a possible recession. Are we talking, though, about the same kind of recession risk in the US and Europe?
Well, for the Eurozone, it seems like something that's very much coming from outside. It's to do with this war. You know, the outlook for the Eurozone economy was actually pretty upbeat before the invasion. And in some ways, it's a choice that Europe itself may have to make. If Europe wants to really ratchet up the pressure on Vladimir Putin, the Russian president, then it will sort of be choosing recession of some kind. I mean, it's very hard to see the Eurozone economy escaping a contraction this year if it goes down that route very soon. In the US, it would likely be the result of some sort of misstep by the Fed or other policymakers as they try and get on top of this inflation problem. Not so much something that's kind of coming from outside, but something that is just inherent to the difficulty of delivering what's called a soft landing, which is to cool an economy down without going so far that you kind of push it over the edge into contraction.
That was WSJ reporter Paul Hannon. Paul, thank you.
Thanks for having me on again, Luke.
Coming up, the Biden administration is enlisting citizens, businesses, and nonprofit groups to sponsor Ukrainian refugees in the U.S. Could it become a new model for helping those fleeing conflict? We'll have that story after the break.
What then will the future reveal?
There's one thing we know about the future. It's being built now.
We all have a stake in the future.
The future.
The future.
The future.
And the Wall Street Journal's Future of Everything podcast is here to give you a glimpse of what's on the way. I'm Danny Lewis. Join us as we dig into how science and technology are shaping the future.
For that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives.
Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Several weeks ago, the Biden administration introduced a new sponsorship program for Ukrainian refugees. It's called Uniting for Ukraine, and it expedites the admissions process for Ukrainians once they've found a U.S. citizen or group to sponsor them. In the first 10 days, the program received more than 14,500 applications. So could private sponsorship become a regular feature of the U.S. refugee admissions program? Wall Street Journal immigration reporter Michelle Hackman says the government could use all the help it can get, especially after America's official resettlement system was overwhelmed by more than 76,000 Afghans last year. And Michelle joins us now with more. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, good to be here.
It's great to have you. So how is this program different from how refugees are normally admitted to the United States?
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting trade-off. Refugees typically come through what we call the Refugee Admissions Program, and that is a process that can take years. You know, the most common situation is you have people living in a refugee camp, let's say in Africa and somewhere in Southeast Asia, and they apply to the U.S. They have to go through a refugee interview. They have to be vetted to make sure they have no ties to terrorism or anything like that. And that takes 2 or 3 years. They go through medical checks. In exchange, when they come, they get two things. They get a green card and they get a lot of assistance from government and non-government organizations, including help finding a home, help finding a job, temporary access to Medicaid and food stamps and English lessons and all the sort of suite of benefits that you need to adjust to America after living in a really precarious situation.
But that is not how this system works for these refugees resettled from Ukraine, is it?
That's right. So the trade-off that's being made here is that system obviously has a lot of benefits, but Ukrainians don't have 2 or 3 years. They need homes right now. And so the U.S. is turning to a different mechanism to allow people in. That's called humanitarian parole, in case any of our listeners have heard that term. And so the benefit of that is it gets Ukrainians here really quick, maybe a week to get that approval. But on the flip side, it means that they get none of those benefits. They get none of the resettlement support from the government, and they don't get green cards.
I understand that under this program, refugees from Ukraine aren't guaranteed any long-term legal status, and that humanitarian parole you mentioned only holds for 2 years. What exactly happens after that?
Right. And that's a reason that this program has gotten a lot of criticism from Ukrainian and refugee groups. A lot of Ukrainians probably feel like they don't have a home to return to in Ukraine. Their city was destroyed, their apartment building was destroyed, whatever it may be. Or other people may feel like, oh my gosh, if I move to America and I find a job and my kids start going to school, I can't uproot myself again in 2 years. You know, I just sort of have to have some peace and dignity. But for those people, it's honestly going to be difficult because, as I said, they have these 2-year grants of permission. A lot of people are going to be eligible for a really similar program called Temporary Protected Status, which has been granted to Ukrainians and will almost certainly be extended by the Biden administration. But temporary programs are difficult. Republicans are not really in favor of them. If a Republican administration gets elected, they'll almost certainly come to an end. And there isn't a direct pathway for these people to get a green card. I mean, the main way that you can do it is if you have a parent, sibling, or child who's an American citizen, or if you find an employer who's willing to sponsor you for a green card, which is quite costly. But those are kind of limited options for people.
Okay, and yet, despite those potential pitfalls, you report that the Biden administration is looking at this program to see if they could use it as a model that could be scaled up. How exactly would that work?
Yeah, it's interesting. There are two aspects. There is sort of the temporary nature of the program, and then there is the private sponsorship, which I would suggest you could separate out. And the Biden administration is looking at doing just that. They're looking at creating a broader private sponsorship model. So exactly how sort of strangers in America are taking in Ukrainians, they don't know. They're trying to get more Americans to step up and do that with more refugees. But the idea would be, once they launch that program, which they're hoping to do by the end of this year, that those people that they're sponsoring would be coming through the regular refugee program. So that means those people arriving would get a green card, that's permanent residence, would get government health care and food stamps and things like that. But the sort of adjustment to America piece of things, what I was talking about, finding a home, enrolling in school, that would be handled by your private sponsor. And that might be, you know, a church or a synagogue or a private volunteer organization or whatever it may be.
That was Wall Street Journal immigration reporter Michelle Hackman. Michelle, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And finally, in Hollywood, the old is new again amid a surge in nostalgic programming that's led the likes of Disney to reboot everything from the Mighty Ducks to Hocus Pocus and even Pinocchio. Whatever strategy Disney's employing seems to be working, as it announced better-than-expected subscription numbers yesterday for its Disney Plus streaming service. WSJ reporter Eric Schwartzel says nostalgic content of the likes that Disney and other streamers are churning out doesn't just provide a TV comfort blanket for viewers. It's also a savvy business move to stand out amid the streaming wars.
It requires less marketing, because if you say, this is a new movie coming out called Three Men and a Baby, there's already a significant share of consumers who can clock that and know what it is, rather than making a comedy about three guys who have to raise a kid and calling it something else. If you're trying to generate automatic buzz, you can kind of lean on the built-in brand equity of that title.
And that's What's News for Thursday morning. We'll be back tonight with a new show. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.